Henry Wood was the founder conductor of the Proms, and we're paying tribute to him this year by recreating his last night of the Proms as heard 100 years ago. The BBC Concert Orchestra, conducted by Paul Daniel, played the original programme of short classics like Wagner's Flying Dutchman Overture and Henry Wood's own now famous Fantasia on British Sea Songs. And, carrying on Henry Wood's commitment to new work, David Matthews has written a piece for the award-winning cellist Stephen Isserlis. So join me, Sarah Moore-Peach, as we step back in time to hear the last night of the Proms from 1910, starting today at 2:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
And in fact, that's just one of two Proms, both celebrating the memory of Sir Henry Wood today. The Ulster Orchestra will be at the Albert Hall at 8 o'clock tonight to present a programme of works either premiered by or closely associated with the founder of the Proms. That's the second Prom at 8 o'clock tonight. And still on the same subject, the Proms Plus event today as part of the Proms Literary Festival takes place at the Royal College of Music at 6:30 this evening. A view of the cultural landscape of the year 1910, from Howards End to Henry Wood. Matthew Sweet and guests are presenting that at 6:30 at the Royal College of Music. And if you're not in the area, then you can always hear it as the interval feature at about 9 o'clock in tonight's Prom. Full details of everything from the Proms website, bbc.co.uk/proms. This is BBC Radio 3. It's a little after 12 midday now, and time for Private Passions with Michael Barclay. And today, another chance to hear a programme first broadcast last December.
Sam Taylor Wood is one of the most musical conceptual artists that I know. Her work has frequently been inspired by or featured music and musicians. Most recently, she directed the John Lennon film Nowhere Boy. Actually, you worked in two guises at the Royal Opera House, didn't you, Sam?
Well, really, my first main job at the Royal Opera House was as a dresser in the men's wardrobe in the opera department. And I started there straight after I finished college because I was a bit lost and I didn't really know quite what I wanted to do. So I went into the men's wardrobe and had one of the best experiences there of my creative mind's life, because it really inspired me and took me to places which I had never been before.
And then you went back later and took photographs. Wonderful photographs.
Yeah, I went back and photographed the ballet, and I felt slightly like a traitor, because there was very distinct difference between the ballet and the opera departments, and each department feels slightly superior to the other one. So, but I went back to work with some of the dancers and photographed them, which was great and inspired a lot of my work, really, because looking at dancers and how they sort of push themselves to such physical extremes, which I do sometimes with my photography too.
And indeed, even to a degree with yourself as a model. I mean, there's a wonderful self-portrait, which I always love and makes me smile when I see it, with you with a chair sort of suspended in most wonderful acrobatic sort of flip.
Yeah, that's called Bram Stoker's chair. It's me sort of poised. It felt sort of like on the edge of a precipice. And so I'm balancing on this chair, which is sort of balancing in turn on one leg. And the chair that has no shadow, which was why I called it Bram Stoker's chair, because I wanted to give it a sense of otherworldliness and slightly sort of falling into a possible dark space where I was at the time.
And then there have been a series of things that you've done with musicians where you often get them to mime the music. So it's not always that they play the music and then, the as it were, the instrument is raised.
Yeah, I've done a couple of pieces. Firstly, I made a piece with a cellist who played a Bach suite. Firstly, I had him play with his cello and then we took it away. Really, the essence of the piece as you see it is that he's passionately playing this piece but with no instrument in front of him. So we kept sort of rehearsing it, but I needed him to sort of really feel the physicality of the instrument but for it to not be there. So then you get this sort of sense of the motion of his body and the engagement with the music and with the instrument, but with the sort of physicality.
So it becomes balletic in some ways.
Yeah, it's quite balletic and quite sort of a passionate piece in a way, because you just see this man sort of in this other world, and it's sort of almost, I don't know, I felt like it was almost shamanistic or something, that just sort of felt like it was summoning up sort of a greater power.
Well, a piece that certainly does summon up a greater power is the first one that we're going to hear, written right at the end of the composer's life. It's a profoundly moving piece.
It's why I chose it, because I just love this piece of music. And I recently rewatched Amadeus, and it reminded me how much I love this piece of music. And just when I was creating the list for this programme, I just thought, I can't leave that out. And I just love how powerful but intensely moving it is.
And one of the things, I don't know about you, but that I love about this opening is that it kind of puts its arms around you almost, doesn't it? It's inexorable. Yes,
absolutely.
It just takes you.
Yeah, no, I love it.
It combines not only music of great drama, but also that sort of almost lilting, caressing sound, doesn't it?
It does, and it makes me feel how great art, great film, great music really makes you feel when your chest starts to expand and you start to sort of, I don't know, breathe in a different way. It fills you with a feeling of being emotionally shifted.
It is almost art as religion, isn't it? There's a kind of sacred sense, even if you're not religious. Do you know
Absolutely.
What I mean?
No, it is. It's elevating.
Interestingly, there, and this also shows that great art can withstand almost anything, is that, compared to early music performances, early music specialists now, that was quite slow. But somehow you've got another element of it, which you wouldn't normally, perhaps, if you heard it done much quicker. That's sort of Leonard Bernstein taking a very romantic view of it with the Bavarian Radio Chorus and Symphony Orchestra, the opening of Mozart's Requiem in D minor, and the soprano soloist was Mary McLaughlin. So, Sam Taylor, have you always loved music?
I have. I grew up with music. Our house was filled with music, but always very different. Anything from Elvis to Wagner to Rod Stewart to anything. So I think that's why I love music so much.
The next piece, I suppose, always takes those of us who loved it to back to a certain period where it kind of defined it, didn't it? Ravi Shankar.
We had a yoga room. My mother and my stepfather were yoga teachers, and there was an altar. And on this altar was a picture of the praying hands on Kyle Gibran's The Prophet. Then there was a little jade Buddha. Then there were some rosary beads. Then there was a poster of Krishna. So there was all of that going on as I was growing up. And I remember, and there was also a crucifix. So, and I remember saying to my mum, coming home from school and people discussing whether they were Catholic or Christian or whatever. And I remember saying to my mum, what religion are we? And she said, Hindu. And I remember thinking, Hindu, I'd never really even heard the word before. And how were we Hindu if I didn't really know what it meant? But I think that was where my mum was in at that period of time. And I remember, you know, a lot of Ravi Shankar music and a lot of people coming around to meditate. And she was a big fan of Yehudi Menuhin. So the combination of the two, I just think is fantastic. And I listen to it a lot still now. And I still practice yoga and I listen to this.
Well, of course,
sometimes.
Yehudi was very keen on yoga. In fact, when I was a child, he was a friend of my father's. And he used to come round and we were allowed as children to come down in our dressing gowns after dinner to watch him standing on his head.
Really? That's amazing. And playing the violin.
So which piece are we going to hear?
This piece, I think because I put on this CD and I play it to the end and do my practice to it. So I wasn't sure which piece to pick. So I picked the first piece from the where I sort of start.
Getting into position.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you.
Chakrabarti. Ravi Shankar was playing the sitar and Yehudi Menuhin the violin, with the great Alaraka playing tabla. That was a mourning raga based on Raga Gunkali. So were there pieces, Sam Taylor-Wood, when you were working as a dresser at the Opera House that you... You must have been experiencing new pieces the entire time. It's a wonderful way of doing it from inside, isn't it?
No, absolutely. And I had totally limited knowledge of opera when I started working there. And the first week I was there, I was working on Verdi's Attila. And I just remember walking around with that sort of butterfly feeling of just excitement and nerves and being sort of part of this build to a bigger performance. And Ruggero Raimondi was playing Attila. And I remember seeing him in the corridor sort of stride past me in all his glory and sort of dressed up, and just thinking, wow, you know, this is just so exciting. And I just was so happy there. I didn't want to do anything else. I just wanted to stay in that world and in that environment. And it was phenomenal. And yeah, from that point, you know, I had a really good sort of education in opera and just worked on, you know, the most fantastic productions.
And was it from that experience that you first discovered the Gluck that we're going to hear next?
Yes, there was a production with Joachim Kowalski, and it was the first time I'd ever heard a countertenor, and I didn't know what one was, and I had to deliver a wig or a shirt or something to his room, and I walked in and he smiled at me, and then he started to sing and I laughed because I thought he was, you know, being silly and performing in front of me. And then I realised he wasn't being silly and that I should get out the room quite quickly because I'd just been really insulting, probably. And then I watched him sing this opera and it was just so moving. And just the whole story, I love the story of this opera. I just think it's so beautifully romantic and just the pain in that first sort of cry of Eurydice, it just always sets my neck hairs on end.
And it's gone on inspiring artists, the Orpheus... visual artists and
absolutely.
Composers like Bert Whistle, absolutely obsessed by it.
Yeah, and I saw a fantastic performance, Pina Bausch performance that she did in Paris. It's just always such a great, it's a great story.
Well, we're going to hear Bernarda Fink as Orfea.
Thank you.
The opening scene of Orfeo ed Euridice by Gluck, and we heard Bernarda Fink singing Orfeo with the Urias Kammerchor and the Freiburger Baroque Orchestra, directed by René Jacobs. You heard absolutely there that wonderful sort of cry at the opening.
Yeah, every time it gets me, it just sends sort of tingles.
How did you come to make this John Lennon film?
A friend of mine passed the script on to me. He gave it to me and said, I've just finished reading this and you have to make this film. It's absolutely your film. He'd directed Atonement, Joe Wright, and he was looking for his next film too. So I said to him, why are you not doing it if it's so good? And he said, I just know it's for you. And I read it and I knew what he meant. And in the moment of finishing that script, I just had this sort of fiery passion of, I've got to get to make this film. I don't know how, because they were already starting and they were, you know, sort of ready.
Do you think that the, having now sort of absolutely immersed yourself in that world, that's part of the success of the Beatles was the conjunction of particularly McCartney and Lennon?
Yeah, I mean, I've really been immersed in the Lennon world. I mean, really in the Lennon world, because for me, when I read the script, it was really about the sort of emotional turbulence of his upbringing and less about the Beatles and what that came to mean. It was really about his upbringing and this sort of tug of war between his mother and his aunt and him sort of being caught in the middle. And there is the meeting of Lennon and McCartney and the power of that relationship as well.
And of course, he always had quite a strong visual sense, didn't he?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And he was brought up by his Aunt Mimi, who really sort of fed him with, knowledge of Van Gogh and Oscar Wilde and, you know, things that I didn't know necessarily. And so I think he always had that sort of imaginative world sort of ticking away in his
mind. Well, if we were to choose a Lennon song, what should we go for?
My current and the favourite for me, and the one that I'd listened to a lot as well during the making of the film, was the song Love. I think it's the most beautiful lyrics, and it just sort of happened to sort of play along, you know, at the time that I was falling in love. So it has a lot of personal resonance, as well as the fact it's the most poetic, beautiful song.
To be loved.
John Lennon's love. I suppose in a way that if we were to make rather simplistic generalisations, then Lennon had a certain Beethovenian turbulence to him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was quite a lot of Sturm und Drang and angst, wasn't there?
Yeah, there was, really there was. And I sort of feel like that when we were making the film, we were trying to think about who he was and how pre what we know and pre what we've seen and the photographs. You know, there's very little documentation of him as a younger man. And so really we decided that the Lennon we all know was formed by the death of his mother and the pain that he went through. And, you know, he said, I lost my mother twice, once at the age of 5 and again at the age of 17. And that's really what our film is about. So you feel that his sort of body language in those sort of early days of Beatles or the days of the Beatles, it's all quite sort of protective, defensive. And I feel that it only then, in my mind, it sort of softened when he then sort of found real love again with Yoko. And that relationship, I think, you know, sort of opened up his heart again.
Well, I mentioned Beethoven there, and it is one of his symphonies that you're very fond of that we're going to hear next. Mm. And I'm rather glad, in a way, that we're not going straight to the great Ode to Joy. Mm-hmm.
starting at the beginning.
Yeah, and the beginning is a rather wonderful moment, and we hear it. People always tend to choose the Ode to Joy, because it is, of course, an extraordinary tune, but it is slightly rhetorical, and I think there are other moments worth savouring.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I picked this one because I haven't listened to it for a while, but I was listening to it at a rather sort of turbulent time of my life. And so it's interesting you said turbulent before. And it was really a time around the death of my great mentor, Anthony Minghella, who really set me on the path to filmmaking and somebody that I will ever be grateful to. And at the time of his death, on the day of his death, my friend Joe, who I mentioned earlier, was making this film, The Soloist, and they were doing this big scene where they were playing this piece in the Great Symphony Hall in Los Angeles. And so he sort of dedicated that performance to him, and it made me listen to it, although I had been recently listening to it. And I was actually on a plane very shortly afterwards and thinking about that piece of music and sort of feeling, in a way, it was sort of very Anthony that, being a film director, it is like conducting in the sense and also like composing. And you're sort of, I felt like he was this sort of great overseer of so many things, and how he would sort of encourage, you know, young artists and young filmmakers, and how he would it was like sort of sprinkle magic over everything, but then also with this huge power and emotion, and everything was sort of so big as well. So it was all of that, which I feel is in this piece. So this piece really sort of reminds me, not necessarily of him as his personality, because he was a very sort of gentle, calm person. But
I was just thinking, as you were saying that, I can remember him sitting where you are now, talking about music. You know?
Yeah, and it was more that I sort of felt like he wasn't that sort of turbulent personality, but he was that sort of powerful personality, and his sort of great sort of overseeing of such sort of grand projects. And I don't know, it just seemed to fit with this music, and also, you know, the sadness really that I felt at the time. And for me, this piece of music really sort of sums up everything around him, but not necessarily him.
Thank you.
It's a different kind of turbulence to the Mozart, isn't it? It's a sort of kind of muscular turbulence.
Mm, it feels much more, I don't know, forceful and out there.
Mm. That was the opening of Beethoven's Ninth Symphony with the Berliner Staatskapelle, conducted by Daniel Barenboim. Well, we were talking just now, Sam Taylor Wood, about Antony Minghella and film, and this is a wonderful use of film music in this next film, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, this film music is so synonymous with the film, and the director, I think, is Wim Wenders, I think he's just a fantastic director, and this film, I feel, is pretty flawless. I rewatched it again recently and just thought visually it's so stunning and how it works.
And of course, he's a great player anyway, right, Kuda?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, working with musicians on the film score that I had, I was really lucky to have Goldfrapp work on the music score, and just working with people where there's a coherence and an understanding, and you're just all feeling exactly the same. And when that works, that sort of synergy, it's powerful. And I really believe they did a brilliant job of helping sort of transport and tell the story. And that's what music does with film. And this film, Paris, Texas, and this piece of music, I think is a perfect case in point of that absolute sort of pairing and how they sort of drive each other to tell the story.
It's wonderful with some musicians and certain pieces of music how within three notes you know who this is. Mm. I mean, you know it with Miles Davis sometimes, you know it with Layla and Eric Clapton, for example. You just hear those notes at the beginning and you're there.
Absolutely. I mean, just that piece of music, it just takes me to a sort of wilderness and a desert. I mean, that image just comes up straight away when I hear that. Mm.
Ray Kuda, Paris, Texas, the film by Wim Wenders. And the other musicians were Jim Dickinson and David Lindley. A song now, Sam Taylor Wood, which I think is very special for you. probably because of the artist.
Nina Simone. Yep, Nina Simone, I just think, is phenomenal. I mean, really phenomenal. I just love her work. And the song that I've chosen, Wild is the Wind, I love the words. I love the passion and the feeling in this. And it's very much, you know, the place in which I'm at the moment. And, you know, it's a song to lie down with someone and listen to.
Wind, kiss me, and with your kiss my life begins. Daddy, you spring to me all things to me.
Such an extraordinary voice, that. And I noticed it has one thing, that style, in common with Ravi Shankar and Rai Kuda, in fact, and to a certain degree John Lennon too, is that ability to just sometimes sing under the note, just to pull away from it, so that it almost causes a friction, so it tears at you.
Yeah, it's almost like you're having to sort of go more into the music to sort of lift out that moment, absolutely.
It's sort of, particularly, I think, with great blues singers, it's pain, isn't it, really?
Yeah, you do. You
it's feel, a needle under the skin.
Yeah, you feel the pain. I like that in music.
Wild is the Wind, Nina Simone. And we also heard Rudy Stevenson, Lyle Atkinson, and Bobby Hamilton. You did, earlier in this year, you chose an opera, an extract, didn't you, to do a little film around?
Yes, I did. Just a short piece of Pagliacci. And it was just a short piece of just seeing, again, the sort of power and the pain in a and how a voice can just sort of transport and tell that, and just seeing the film of just that one person singing that. It was fantastic for me to do, and a good thing.
We were talking about the Mozart Requiem earlier, and coming at the end of his life, and we were talking about Lennon's turbulence, and indeed Beethoven's, and you've surmounted several obstacles in your life. I mean, famously cancer, and you know, breakups, and things like, indeed everybody does to a certain extent. But do you find that does inform not just what you do, but what you want to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think having been through cancer twice, it's made me pretty fearless about how I live my life. You know, people said to me, aren't you afraid going onto a film set for your first day and shooting a film? I said, why would I be afraid? You know, the only thing that's fearful for me is hospitals and doctors and, you know, stuff that's really life and death. And making a film is not fearful. It's absolutely exhilarating and exciting. And so taking on such big challenges, they don't frighten me.
Do you think you might have to again, a little bit of a generalisation, but sort of fight off Hollywood to be yourself? Because you're obviously getting considerable success with this Lennon thing, but you are an artist and you probably don't want to lose that.
Yeah, I did a trip out to Hollywood just last 2 weeks ago, and it terrified the life out of me. I went there to meet with people, and I just thought, get me home. I really, you know, I'm a big supporter of the British film industry, and I feel that, you know, we're making some great films here. Why go there? Let's stay here. Well, who knows, though? Maybe I'll regret saying that in a few years.
Well, actually, it's a Jane Campion film that you're going to, as it were, champion next musically.
Yeah, I mean, Jane Campion, I think, is a phenomenal film director, and there aren't that many women directors. I don't know why necessarily, other than from my own experiences. It's tough industry. It's quite male dominated, and if you've got kids,
as you've got two,
I've got two, and I know that Jane Campion has one. It's hard to juggle everything, and so I champion her because she's my champion. You know, she's somebody that I look to think, well, if she can do it, I can do it, and she does it brilliantly, I think. And the piano is absolutely one of my favourite films for many reasons. Performances, beauty, the way it's directed, but I love this score that was done by Michael Nyman. I think it's just brilliant, I really do.
We couldn't help chatting during that, not because we weren't enjoying it, but because you were saying, we were talking about the balance of getting music right. And I remember Anthony Minghella saying, just to go back to that for a minute, how it was no good if the music stole the show, as it were. So it's got to be a counterpoint to what's going on the screen. And sometimes that means it has to be something which is not too strong.
Absolutely, because I feel when I watch film, I want to see and feel the emotion or the drama. And I want the music to sort of help me on that journey, but I don't want the music to take me on that journey too much, so that I'm aware of the music that I'm losing a sense of myself in it. I love that feeling of guiding you, really. It should be a sort of gentle guiding through the emotion and not absolutely overpowering.
And not a wallpaper to get over problems.
No, but it shouldn't be overpowering. It's, you know, sometimes you see films where you just think, you know, I want to turn the music down or I want to change it because I can't feel, because it's telling me what to feel. I want to feel it myself.
So that sometimes that one almost doesn't want a sort of stonking masterpiece.
No,
because you actually want something which is slightly understated.
It just has to be a balance between sound and picture, really. And it just has to be that balance, again, of emotion, that it's not too overpowering that you can't feel because you're being told how to feel. You've got to be able to be left how to feel.
Well, that comes rather fortuitously from somebody who's used the BBC Concert Orchestra without their instruments.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Well, we heard Michael Nyman with his music for the piano, the track The Heart Asks Pleasure First. Thank you very much, Sam Taylor-Wood, for letting us into these little byways and highways of your musical tastes.
No, thank you. It's been a really good experience. Thank you.
Sam Taylor Wood was talking to Michael Barclay. That programme was first broadcast last December. Next Sunday, Michael Barclay's guest on Private Passions will be the media entrepreneur Peter Bazalgette. Same time next Sunday, that's midday. Private Passions is a classic arts production for BBC Radio 3. Today's edition was produced by Sarah Cropper. Well, in a couple of minutes, the early music show at this summer's Dartington Summer School and music making from the Defy Collective. This is BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and online. It's 1 o'clock, time for the news read by John Shea.
The Basque separatist group ETA has announced a ceasefire in its armed campaign. It said it will try to gain independence for the region through democratic means. The Spanish government hasn't yet responded. ETA's violent campaign has led to more than 800 deaths in the past 40 years. It's unclear whether the ceasefire is permanent. The group has twice abandoned ceasefires in the past. A British soldier has died in an explosion in Helmand province in Afghanistan. He was from 1st Battalion, the Royal Regiment of Scotland, serving as part of the Brigade Reconnaissance Force, his family have been told. The Education Secretary, Michael Gove, has said there'll be 16 so-called free schools in England by next September. The schools will be set up by parents, businesses or charities, but within the state system. Mr Gove said the take-up was well above expectations, but Labour called the figure an embarrassment. Mr Gove also said there'd be 140 new academy schools this academic year. The head of the Catholic Church in England and Wales has said it's right that taxpayers should help pay for the Pope's trip to Britain this month. The government will contribute up to £12 million. The Archbishop of Westminster, Vincent Nicholls, said it would be a sad day if the UK said it couldn't afford state visits. Long queues are continuing outside branches of Kabul Bank across Afghanistan because of fears that it may collapse. The government has said it will not let it fail. Soldiers, police and teachers are paid through the bank. Pakistan's High Commissioner to the UK has said three cricket players accused of spot-fixing should be banned for life if they're found guilty. Salman Butt, Mohammad Asif and Mohammad Amir are being investigated by police and the ICC. More details and transcripts of conversations were published in this morning's News of the World. England play Pakistan in a 2020 match this afternoon. And the weather, it'll be a dry, cloudy afternoon for most of the UK with some rain in southern England. This evening there'll be rain in Northern Ireland, most of Wales and parts of the Midlands. The news and weather on BBC Radio 3 at 2 minutes past one.
And it was read by John Shea. Well, it's time now for the second of this weekend's early music shows. Here's Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show and the second of our visits this weekend to Dartington International Summer School near Totnes in Devon. Yesterday we heard about its history and from some of the tutors who travel there each year to coach the students, a mix of up-and-coming professionals and amateurs in the truest sense of the word, all of whom delight in spending a week or so doing what they love best, making music together. Each evening, after a day filled with choral singing, orchestras, consort playing, madrigals and, weather permitting, spontaneous dance sessions on the lawn, as many people as possible squeeze into Dartington's centrepiece, the great medieval hall, for a concert given by the various course tutors. Today, we're hearing highlights from a concert given by some old friends of the early music show, the Defy Collective. Their programme focused on English secular music, medieval ballads and dance tunes alongside some of the popular music heard in the streets and taverns of the 17th century. Later on, I'll be chatting with their leader, Bill Lyons, about the group's music and their work at Dartington. But first, let's hear them in action with the two pieces from the 14th century that began their concert. The song Brid on a Brier, an analogy of love unrequited, followed by an instrumental dance.
Thank you.
A rollicking start to the concert given by the Dufai Collective at Dartington Hall. A dance version of an old ballad tune with bagpipes, symphony, violin and a lot more besides. And before that, one of the very few surviving English secular songs from the Middle Ages, Brid on a Brier, sung by Vivian Ellis. We'll hear her again now in a haunting song accompanied by the harp. It's a beautiful lyric, a heartfelt and very personal plea to God and to Jesus to have pity on humankind. From the prison that I'm in, bring me out and make me free, writes the anonymous poet. Though man can ascend to the heights, death will fell him to the ground. Worldly prosperity for certain lasts but 1 hour. Thank you.